From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang, filling in for A. Martinez. Thanks so much for joining us. So, as many of you know, today was the great shakeout when Californians across the state practiced earthquake drills. The imaginary quake took place at 10:17 this morning. Did you drop, cover, and hold on? I hope so. If not, we'll have some more detailed advice on prepping for the big one with seismologist Lucy Jones. We'll also tell you about the history of LA's Watts Towers and how they were almost destroyed several decades ago. That's all coming up, so stay with us. But we start our show with a new earthquake alert system, which happens to coincide with the 30th anniversary of one of the most destructive quakes in U.S. history. The Loma Prieta quake was a magnitude 6.9 and shook parts of the Bay Area near Santa Cruz. 63 people were killed and more than 3,500 were injured. In 1989, there was no way to warn residents that the quake was on its way. But now, the state is hoping to warn Californians before disaster strikes. The U.S. Geological Survey has launched a statewide version of LA's Shake Alert app, an early warning system for quakes. Joining me now to walk through these developments is KPCC's science reporter Jacob Margolis. Welcome back, Jacob.
Hey, Josie.
So, Jacob, Angelenos have had a version of the Shake Alert app for, it's been 10 months now, I believe. What will this new app do for the state as a whole?
Our app only applies to LA County. This new app is any corner of the state you go to. So you go camping, you just turn it on. Hopefully it's always on. And you just kind of go wherever. And it'll flag you if there is an imminent quake coming your way.
So is this new statewide app, does it work the same way? Is it supported by the same kind of technology as the one we got for the city of LA?
It is. There's a backbone that's been built by places like USGS and Caltech that has put a bunch of sensors along a bunch of faults or near faults. And when those first waves are released by that earthquake, those sensors detect them, send it to some computers that translate it into potential size and problem. And then those push it out to an emergency alert system, which then like flags it for people. So, it's all kind of part of the same system.
So that sounds very helpful, but I already have the LA app, so do I need to download the state one too? I mean, how are they different?
Yeah, the LA app is going to have information about after the earthquake, so where shelters might be available, you know, assuming we have internet, that'll be super helpful. The other app feels a little more science-y. They actually use an accelerometer on the phones to track movement and kind of crowdsource quake movement and all around the areas that the quake happens. So I have both.
Yeah, it sounds like it doesn't hurt to have both. We're talking with KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis, and he's our resident earthquake expert, Jacob. So in addition to this new app being announced today, there is also a new study that came out of Caltech that goes deep on the Ridgecrest quake. What does it say?
Yeah, it really dove deep on the data, and Ridgecrest was really cool. The first big quake in California in 20 years, and it's also one of the most well-documented because after the 6.4 foreshock happened, all these scientists just rushed out to the desert with their field equipment and started measuring everything, especially as the Earth started to set, before the Earth completely settled. And they wanted to understand how everything moved. And what they found and what the study gets into is that the quake happened in a really complex way. And the biggest highlight for me of the study is that the 7.1 magnitude quake, that was the second one that hit at night. It wasn't just one big fault that went off. At the time, we thought that could have been the case. It turns out it was like 20 plus faults that kind of strung together to create that big quake.
So just stepping back, why is this important for us to know in terms of understanding and predicting when earthquakes are going to happen again?
Because the way that we've assessed earthquake risk, and this is super duper duper simplifying it, is that we look at a fault like, say, the San Andreas. Say it's super long, it's slipping fast. We could see big earthquakes on it because the size of the fault it's directly related to like the magnitude of earthquakes that are possible. Now, what this study shows is that we can have not just one big fault that slips and creates a big quake, but a bunch of small faults that come together to create a big quake. We have seen this before. Scientists very much know that this can happen. It happened in Landers in 92, Hector Mines in 99. So it's not completely unknown. That said, I spoke with Morgan Page over at USGS. She's one of the authors of California's earthquake rupture forecast.
Okay.
And she told me that they factored this in, but could factor it in a bigger way in the future. This further supports this whole idea that a bunch of small kind of faults could come together to create something big. And that raises the question of like, okay, so should we assess risk differently in places where maybe we don't see big faults? Maybe there are faults that aren't known, which I know they do consider, but you know, maybe we got to rethink some of this.
So on Take Two, we've talked a lot about the different faults around the state. And our listeners might remember back when Ridgecrest hit this past July, there was talk about the giant Garlock fault, which is nearby. Remind us why that is a big deal and what this study today says about it.
Yeah, it's a huge fault that bisects California. It connects with the San Andreas over near the coast. It's capable of producing like an 8.0 magnitude earthquake. It's really big. It also hasn't moved in a long time. And what these Ridgecrest quakes did is they shifted the earth that made it move. And we've seen a swarm of earthquakes on the Garlock, very, very, very small. And it raises the question of, does this increase our risk of a bigger quake on the Garlock, which could be devastating? And does it increase the risk of like a San Andreas event? These are just questions. As far as we know, I haven't seen anything where no one said to me that there's a high likelihood of something happening. So it's interesting kind of in the science world, right, that something like this could happen. We might change our considerations about what's possible in the future.
All right. We've been speaking to KPCC's science reporter, Jacob Margolis. He's been bringing us up to speed on earthquakes in California. Jacob, thanks for joining us in studio.
Thanks, Josie.
Because today is the Great Shakeout, we thought we'd share some earthquake safety tips from seismologist Dr. Lucy Jones. Jones is considered the expert when it comes to earthquake science in California, and she is also one of the biggest public advocates for quake safety. Here's her advice on how to prepare for the big one.
The first thing I would like everyone in LA to do about earthquakes is to go talk to their neighbor about them. I think the biggest threat to the future of Los Angeles is that we will come apart as a community when faced with the stress of an earthquake. When you've talked about it with your neighbor or your family or the people at your church or the people at your kid's school, now that's a little more incentive to get things done. You can do it together and do it better. What should you be doing after you've talked this through? Number one, make your house as safe as it can be, which is a combination of getting a foundation specialist to make sure you're actually well hooked to your house and going through the inside of your house to see what's going to fall down. If I shook that, would it fall? Where would it fall? How heavy is it? Is that really valuable to me? I don't want to lose it. Or I'd really like a new set of dishes anyway. We can let them go. If this bookcase is coming down on your kid's bed, probably not a good idea. There are some things you can't prevent because they're communal, like our water system. And it's probably the most vulnerable piece of infrastructure in California. So however much water you already have, get some more. I don't do a disaster kit, you know, the go bag, because we're not going to predict the earthquake. After it happens, you're probably staying at your house. But you may not be at your house. And if you're an Angeleno, you probably have a car with you. So this type of supplies that it's good to have in the car include some water, walking shoes, if you regularly wear those shoes, especially that women wear that maybe you don't want to be walking 20 miles in, a Mylar blanket, a little first aid kit, solar panels to charge your phone. Notice all of those to me are more sort of prevention. Why figure out how to pick up the pieces instead of preventing the pieces in the first place?
That was world-renowned seismologist Dr. Lucy Jones sharing her advice on how to prepare in case of an earthquake. The prospect of a major earthquake looms large here, and so does another issue, affordability. Angelenos are generally less satisfied with their lives than people in other parts of the country. That's according to a new survey from the University of Southern California. Researchers say the high cost of living is partly to blame. Sociologist Kyla Thomas directs USC's LA Barometer Survey, and she joins us now. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi, Josie. Thanks for having me.
So you found that LA residents care a lot about affordability. How is that influencing their outlook on life?
So we did a survey of about 1,700 LA County residents, and we also did a national survey, and we measured life satisfaction both at the local level and at the national level, and we find that more LA County residents are satisfied with their lives than not. But when you compare average life satisfaction in LA to the national average, we find that life satisfaction in LA is lower than the national average. And we did some additional analyses to try to understand why that's the case. And we find that when we account for differences in cost of living across regions in the U.S., the life satisfaction gap disappears. So essentially, a cost of living seems to be a primary driver of this gap that we're seeing.
So it sounds like the happiness fix, could it be as simple as if we just all made more money in L.A. County?
So no, that's actually not what we find. You know, one idea could be that, oh, maybe people in LA make less, and that's why they're less satisfied with their lives. But we find actually, even when we account for differences in income, we're still seeing that life satisfaction gap. So it's really about what you make relative to what everything costs in the area you live in.
Okay, so it's personal finances, cost of living in particular, that are making Angelenos less satisfied than people living somewhere where the cost of living is lower, let's say Iowa?
Exactly. And we suspect that if we did this kind of survey in other, you know, cities or counties that are known for high cost of living, we might see similar kind of lower life satisfaction relative to the national average.
So we know that Angelenos don't like living in LA because it's so expensive to live here. So what do they like about living here?
Well, one thing we find that they like is their neighborhood. And we find that about 70% of residents are somewhat satisfied, or very satisfied with the neighborhood they're living in.
But wait, Kyla, I'm looking here, and it also says that at the same time that they like their neighborhoods and their neighbors, that they don't spend that much time with their neighbors. How does that work?
Yeah, so people who feel like their neighbors are trustworthy and they're kind of watching out for the neighborhood tend to feel more satisfied with the neighborhood they're living in. But then we ask them how much time they spend socializing with their neighbors, and we find that, yeah, people don't, you know, interact with their neighborhoods all that frequently. They much more frequently interact with friends and relatives.
So even though LA residents are less satisfied with their lives than in other parts of the country, your study also found that most of them are going to stick it out here because, hey, it's LA, it's the weather, whatnot. But some do plan to leave. And what can you tell us about this cohort?
Yeah, so we asked people about their plans for the next year, if they plan to stay in their current residence or move. And then if they plan to move, we asked them, where do you plan to move to? And we find that about 79% of LA County residents plan to stay in their current residence in the next year. 7% plan to leave LA County altogether. And then the rest plan to move, but somewhere else in LA County. And interestingly, we asked them then why. And we find that affordability tops the list for everybody. So if you feel like your mortgage or your rent is affordable, that's the most frequently cited reason why people plan to stay in their current housing. And the most frequently cited reason why people plan to move out of LA or move out of their housing is also because they find their rent or mortgage unaffordable.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kyla, we're talking to you as you've just completed the first LA barometer survey, and it's supposed to track the same group of LA County residents over time. What are you planning to do with all this info you're getting?
Yeah, we're collecting a lot of data. We're really excited about it. And this is just, yes, the first of a long series of surveys that we'll be doing. We'll be doing a survey every quarter. We're focusing on four key issues in LA, so livability, mobility, affordability, and sustainability. You know, by tracking people over time, we think we can produce a lot of unique data that will be very beneficial to policy decision makers and service providers in LA. You know, we can measure policy impacts. We can see how people's lives change over time as social conditions in LA change. And we're really hoping that the data we produce will fill some data gaps and answer some big questions in LA.
So what are you guys looking at next?
Our next survey will be on mobility. We asked people at the end of our livability survey what they like most and least about living in LA. And the most commonly used word when people responded to what they like least about LA was traffic. So we'll definitely be asking about that. But we also want to understand, you know, how are people traveling to work? How are they making decisions about their travel mode? How do they feel about public transit in LA? All sorts of questions like that.
We've been speaking with Kyla Thomas. She's a sociologist who directs USC's new LA Barometer Survey. Kyla, thanks so much for taking the time with us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on Take Two, when you think of after-school programs, there's exercise, play, fun in the sun. Well, what about junk food? We checked out what LA's after-school programs are feeding the kiddos, and let's just say there's a lot of sugar and fat in those snacks. Kids love them, surprise, but we don't always love what's great for us, especially given LA County's high child obesity rates. Stay tuned to hear more about this. Back with Take Two, I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. For working parents, the City of LA's Department of Recreation and Parks offers affordable and convenient options for after-school care. But it may not be the healthiest choice for kids. KPCC's Alyssa Joan Perry found that more than half of the snacks bought for some after-school programs is junk food, like chips, cookies, candy, and fruit punch.
You want fruit punch, cheese, pepperoni?
It's snack time at the after-school club at Eagle Rock Recreation Center.
Wait, is there punch?
You need to go put your food down.
LA's Department of Recreation and Parks runs 90 after-school programs throughout the greater LA area, serving more than 3,000 kids. Kids get shuttled from public schools to nearby recreation centers. There, they get homework help, playtime, and a daily snack. And those snacks are often high in fat and sugar. KPCC reviewed snack receipts for the last school year from six different after-school clubs run by the Park and Recs Department and found some rec centers bought healthier food than others. But overall, fresh fruits and vegetables accounted for just 5% of all their food purchases. And as for drinks, Capri Sun pouches and fruit punch dominated the budget. Lorraine Ritchie is a child nutrition expert at the Nutrition Policy Institute. She says that while a couple of Oreos and a glass of fruit punch for snack may not seem so bad, it adds up.
It's not massive gorging that contributes usually to obesity. It's just the small amount of extra calories every day.
Last year, almost half of fifth graders in LA County were considered to be overweight or obese. That's according to data from the California Department of Education. In an effort to tackle childhood obesity, all public schools that get federal dollars for meals and snacks must follow federal nutrition guidelines. That includes Los Angeles Unified School District. Those rules do not apply to after-school programs at LA's Rec and Parks because they don't get federal money for snacks. But the City of LA does have its own nutrition guidelines for city programs that serve kids, the Child Nutrition Policy. The city council passed it almost 15 years ago.
So it's going to take a few years before this really sinks in, but we'll have healthier generations, and that's what's important.
The citywide policy directs rec centers and other city departments to provide healthy, low-fat, low-sugar food for kids and to train staff on the nutrition guidelines. Vicki Israel says she managed several recreation centers for Parks and Rec at that time. Now she's the assistant general manager of the department and oversees the after-school programs. She remembers the child nutrition policy.
Actually, I was one of the co-authors of it.
A task force made up of nutrition advocates and city officials, including now Mayor Eric Garcetti, developed the policy, and they were supposed to enforce it.
The department did take a very active role in providing trainings. We even came up with a list of potential snacks for staff to purchase.
Snacks like apple slices and 100% fruit juice. So why are kids in rec and parks after school programs still getting sugary beverages and high fat junk food?
I think things did fall down. Over the years, a lot of personnel has changed, to be quite honest with you.
Israel says she can't remember if the task force enforced the child nutrition policy or what happened to the task force. KPCC reached out to several other people on the task force, including Garcetti. They didn't seem to know either. But Israel says since KPCC started reporting this story, she's reminded rec center staff to make healthy choices when buying snacks. At Alpine Rec Center in LA's Chinatown, brothers Stephen and Abel Knapp are going home from the after-school program. They say there have been some recent changes in the snacks they get.
They give out punch, but now they give water
because they ran out of punch.
Abel corrects his brother. They stopped getting punch, Abel says, because the parents complained. Covering health, I'm Melissa Jung Perry.
There's a political storm brewing for Blizzard. That's the video game company based in Irvine and publisher of incredibly popular titles such as World of Warcraft and Overwatch. The controversy started last week when a professional gamer from Hong Kong publicly supported the months-long pro-democracy protests in the city. Blizzard forced that player to forfeit some prize money and banned him from the game Hearthstone for a year. That rankled many players in the U.S., where our cherished value of free speech is colliding with an American company that wants to do business in China. And those tensions are rising ahead of the Blizzard Convention, or BlizzCon, coming up in just a few weeks right here in Anaheim. To catch us up to speed, we have Nathan Grayson. He's a reporter for the video game website Kotaku.
Hello.
So, Nathan, we should note that in a blog post, the company's president said, quote, "Our relationships in China had no influence on our decision." But do American video game players necessarily believe that?
They definitely don't. Blizzard is going to say what they're going to say. I think that they definitely do have business interests in China. For one thing, they are partially owned by a company called Tencent.
And that's a Chinese company.
Yeah, they're like a Chinese mega publisher. They actually have ownership stakes in a lot of video game companies, including Epic Games, who actually came out and said they'd be fine with players making political statements during broadcasts. But like, naturally, a company like Blizzard is going to want to be especially cautious around a topic like this. I think as much as Blizzard wants to say this isn't about their business interests or about the particular thing that player said, you can't really say it's not.
Well, let's talk about what the stakes are. How big of a market does China represent for American video game companies?
An increasingly enormous one. For a lot of American companies, they're starting to make games that are solely for that market or mainly for that market. And like, Blizzard is definitely part of that. Some of their games, I think, get nearly as many players in China as they do in America, if not more. China is an absolutely enormous part of where video games are headed.
Now, you mentioned just a little bit ago that there's another esports company that is okay with players making political statements. So it sounds like there isn't really consensus right now in the video game industry about how to handle these outspoken players, right?
Definitely not. Epic Games, who creates and publishes Fortnite, the president of that company went on Twitter and said basically, hey, if players want to make statements like this during our broadcasts, that's okay with me. Meanwhile, another publisher, Riot Games, the creator of League of Legends, published a long letter without any real prompting and said, like, we do not allow political statements during our broadcasts. We've reminded players and commentators of this, and that's that. So right now, I think there are a lot of companies sort of reacting to this both internally and externally. One way or another, this will be a moment that kind of decides the future of how video game companies handle these issues.
So how similar is this incident to what's going on right now with the NBA and the creators of South Park, who are both dealing with censorship issues in China?
I mean, it's not just there either. It's also like Apple has been having issues with, you know, apps people are making that are on these topics. And Apple's been like, well, no, we can't allow those to be on our store. But yeah, no, this is definitely a big cultural moment in terms of how do we handle this. And, you know, right now it seems like a lot of companies are willing to push down what might be construed as pro-Hong Kong or anti-Chinese commentary in the name of making sure that their bottom lines are secure.
So this has also put a geopolitical twist on protests and sports, since this situation has a lot in common, it seems, with the domestic NFL controversy that's been centered around Colin Kaepernick and him kneeling during the national anthem.
So on one hand, there's the overt parallel of this being somebody doing a form of protest during a sporting event. But I also think it's a little bit different, too. The Kaepernick stuff was primarily concerned with racism in America. And the stuff with Blizzard in Hong Kong is, I think, a little bit more concerned, initially at least, it was more concerned with like fears over censorship in a video game league. And then it sort of branched out into touching on a lot of other issues as well.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us now, we're speaking to Nathan Grayson. He's a reporter for the video game website Kotaku. Nathan, Blizzard canceled a high-profile event in New York yesterday and gave no explanation. And in just a few weeks, this issue will come to our own backyard when the company hosts its annual convention and expo in Anaheim called BlizzCon. So 40,000 people attended last year. What do you think is going to happen this year?
It will definitely be a very different year than it has been previously. Generally, BlizzCon is big and celebratory and all about people coming together and being like, you know, we like this company, we like their games. And this year, there is a lot of displeasure surrounding this company and its games. I recently reported out a piece on plans for protests at BlizzCon. There are a couple groups so far who definitely are working on what they're going to do. One of them is a group that has a lot of previous experience running these sorts of actions. They're called Fight for the Future. And then on the flip side of that, there is a subreddit that's just called Protest BlizzCon that already has over 2,000 people. And it's being put together by a couple people who have no experience protesting. And so they're all taking relatively similar approaches, which is show up in mass, in costume, and voice your displeasure with what Blizzard has done. Nearby hotels that host a lot of the people who stay there, local law enforcement, all of them are aware that these kinds of things are likely to happen and are, you know, taking precautionary measures.
Mm-hmm. And Blizzard, of course, is not the only local video game company. You've got others that are based here in Southern California. I got to think that they've been watching this controversy with great interest and trepidation. What have you been hearing from them about how this whole incident went down and what they're going to do if something similar happened with one of their games?
In the long run, a lot of other companies are going to base their decisions on what's happening here. And so what we're kind of looking for at this point is, will this over time kind of flare out? Will people stop caring? Will Blizzard's decision ultimately stand? And then in the future, when something like this occurs again, if it occurs again, will Blizzard, you know, put its foot down and people will be like, well, that's just the way things are. Those are the rules. If that ends up happening, then I think a lot of companies will follow suit because that's kind of the path of least resistance for them. But if people continue to be up in arms about this, then I think we'll see a fair number of companies maybe reconsider that particular stance.
Right. Who knew Blizzard would be the test case? Nathan Grayson, reporter for the video game website Kotaku, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us on Take Two. We have a story coming up for you about one of LA's most iconic landmarks and Instagram faves. I'm talking about Watts Towers, those fantastical spires that just shoot up into the sky in the middle of this low-lying residential neighborhood. Sculptures that forever have a place in our city's history and culture. But did you know, I didn't know this, that the towers almost met an early demise? We'll have a conversation coming up with the archivist for the city of LA about this. Stay with us. Now
Now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. This morning, LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner and Board of Education Vice President Jackie Goldberg unveiled an 18-foot-long Rodea bench at Simon Rodea Continuation High School. The bench is in honor of an artist and Italian immigrant named Simon Rodea, the man behind one of LA's most quintessential structures, the Watts Towers. The 17 interconnected towers and sculptures were built over the course of three decades and have come to represent the art and culture of our city. But did you know the structure narrowly escaped demolition? That's the topic of this week's Throwback Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Michael Holland is the archivist for the City of Los Angeles. He spoke with A. Martinez about the towers and the man who created them, Simon Rodea.
Simon Rodea built the towers basically as a project unto itself. I mean, he was asked a number of times what its significance was, why he did it, and the most famous quote is, "I had it in my mind to do something big and did it."
I know I want to do something. I say, I'm going to do something. I'm going to do something. I'm going to do something.
Wow.
So that's
that simple.
That's his story, and he stuck with that. So from about 1921 through about 1954, he would build these towers one at a time with scrap metal, chicken wire, cement. And then once he had the form made out, he would then stick shells, bottle fragments, stones, all sorts of mosaic material into the wet cement. And he lived on the property. So he had his little house there. And when he wasn't working as a tile mason or as a telephone lineman, which would explain the skill set that he had to climb up and down these things pretty much without ladders, although there are some ladders in some of the photos I've seen. But he had this vision that only he knew. And so he took about 33 years to create all of the structures.
Wow.
And then for reasons that are pretty much unknown, he left town.
Took off to the city of Martinez, California, one of my favorite towns in the whole state.
Yep, he went up there and did not come back.
Yeah.
And so the only people who really knew that much about the towers themselves at that time were basically the neighbors, the people in the neighborhood,
Oh. You
know, because they saw them. You know, they watched them all the time. Now, by 1957 or so, the property got the notice of the Building and Safety Department. And what they did was they issued an order of demolition on the property.
Mm-hmm.
Several things had happened. The house itself that Rodea had lived in had burned a year or so after he left. Now, the property had been sold to someone else, and that individual wanted to keep the towers. And so the city comes along, takes a look at this, says, they've got to come down. And so they wrote up an order of demolition, and of course, it's immediately challenged. And as all these things do, they take time to adjudicate, and so it took about 2 years to get this to where the Building and Safety Commission scheduled a series of meetings to talk about the hazard of the towers and why they should come down. And
that was
the city's position.
Yeah.
Now, the owners, they had formed a coalition to save the Rodea Towers, which they weren't called the Watts Towers, they were called the Rodea Towers.
And by then, by 1959, it was owned by Nicholas King.
Yes. Nicholas King was an actor, and he recognized the artistic value of the towers. And so with him and some of his friends, they organized a coalition to save the Rodea Towers, as they were called. And so by July of 1959, there was a series of meetings scheduled with the Building and Safety Commission to discuss the future of the towers. And so you have the city on one side arguing that the towers, they're a menace, they're dangerous to children, and the slightest wind was going to knock them down. And as structures, they're unsafe. Jack Levin, who was the attorney for the coalition, said, no, you've got it all wrong. First of all, according to the building code, these aren't buildings. And then he went through line by line saying a building is something that has a roof and is habitable. By no stretch of the imagination are these structures habitable.
No way. No way.
The house itself was that had been there, that's already gone. That's demolished. That is not even a factor in this discussion. And so they went back and forth on that. They brought in, the city brought in their building inspectors. They brought in their engineers. They claimed that a strong windstorm, a good Santa Ana wind, would knock the towers over, and it would knock over across the street into an adjoining property if it went this way or that way. And
so what do they do? I mean, do they really like test the towers?
That's actually what happened. There was an aeronautic engineer by the name of Goldstein, and he got wind of all this, and he's looking at this, and he realizes, you know, if you guys are looking at these as aerodynamic structures, they can, and in fact would, survive anything that Mother Nature could throw at it, in so many words. And so what he proposed, and they allowed him, to do a series of stress tests. And so what they did is that they literally took a very large truck and crane with, I believe it was 10 tons of dead weight, attached them to several parts of each of the main structures.
Oh, no.
And then decided to pull them down. Now they're measuring all this stuff. I mean, keep in mind, these are actual aerospace engineers, yeah. You know, very early aerospace engineers. And so what they're doing is they're surveying the top of the tower, and they have all their other measuring instruments. And so they basically put the screws to the truck. They add more weight. And finally, there was so much weight on the truck that it could not move.
Just to be clear, this is the side that wants to save the towers,
absolutely,
right? Okay. I just want to be sure.
Right. Basically, these are the good guys in our story.
Yeah.
And so they do this test, and they calculated that the top of the tower, when all this was said and done, with the full 10 tons of dead weight and all the horsepower they could use to try to pull the bottom of the tower out, that the top of the tower moved maybe an inch and a quarter.
Wow.
Now, that's pretty insignificant movement. And that's with all this intervention. I mean, a windstorm wasn't going to do anything like that. The earthquakes, ironically, have probably been more problematic, but that's a whole other story.
Was there any accounting for their structural stability? Was Simon Rodia that gifted of an engineer that he made these towers that indestructible?
The thinking seems to be that they were built strong enough with good material, even though the plaster had been cracking and continues to crack, and that's why the whole facility is now undergoing a retrofit right now for the next year or two to fix it up. But no, they were just very well built. And this was from a guy who, we know so little about his life, but there's certainly no way he would have had an education in engineering, in aerodynamics, in construction. I mean, none of that. So where the inspiration came from? He said that the towers in Italy inspired him.
Yeah.
Well, somehow or other, he found a way to build these things without permit, which is probably one of the things that really got the city upset with him, and built them so well that when they wanted to take them down, they couldn't do it. The fun thing is, in looking at the documents that we have in the archive, is all the letters of support. There were so many people, regular folks, as well as real architects, real art historians, submitted letters of support to the city, to the mayor, to the city council, saying, don't let this happen. And so there was enough of a groundswell where the Building and Safety Commission decided, okay, we'll let them stay.
So people cared enough.
Cared enough. And I think basically the Building and Safety they ran out of excuses. Their math did not add up at the end of the day.
The towers are such a symbol of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I mean, the watchtowers are pretty much L.A.
Yeah.
Can you even imagine, Michael, for a second, what we would have lost if somehow the city had went ahead and demolished them like they had planned?
No, not in the same respect to say what happened when they flattened Bunker Hill, for example, or some other areas of the city that have gone through renovation in the name of progress. I mean, preservationists, of course, will make those sorts of arguments all the time. There's discussion now what's happening with LACMA. So, no, I mean, we would have lost quite a bit. And the fact that some of the best things that the city has to offer are completely off the books. They're unplanned. They don't make sense. But on the other hand, it's art. It's art with a capital A. You know, whatever else Rodia was. And by the way, they sent him letters to come and be part of the discussion in 1959. And the letters all were sent back.
So the guy who built the watchtowers wasn't part of the effort to save him?
Nope. So when he walked away from the city, he walked away from everything that he had done. And I think that's one of the enduring mysteries.
But he left us a beautiful gift.
He certainly did.
Michael Holland is the archivist for the city of Los Angeles. He joined me to talk about how the watchtowers were almost demolished back in the 50s. Mike, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
So earlier in the show, we had seismologist Lucy Jones giving us some really useful tips on how to protect you and your loved ones in the event of an earthquake. Well, we've got more for you on earthquake safety. We're going to take you to Long Beach to a mock disaster drill. It's all part of a program designed to train regular folks on how to be first responders. It's a federal program, but got its start in SoCal. We'll be back in a few moments to tell you more. You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. It was the great shakeout this morning, that annual ritual in California where we review what to do in case a real earthquake occurs. Because of this, we thought it was a perfect day to dust off a story we did a few years ago about CERT. Community Emergency Response Training is what that means, and it aims to teach regular people on how to be first responders. It started here in LA, but it's now a national program made available through the Federal Emergency Management Agency. A couple years ago, FEMA recognized the CERT program in Long Beach for outstanding community preparedness. So we sent Take Two contributor Adriana Cargill to a mock disaster drill to check it out for us.
It's a typical afternoon in Southern California. Skies are clear, the weather's warm, life is good. When all of a sudden, the ground starts to shake. This feels like the big one, the one everyone has been dreading. A 7.6 earthquake just hit LA County. Cars are flipped over and fires are smoldering.
Tell me what happened.
You see a six-story building that looks partially destroyed, black from fire. In the days of the destruction, you walk in.
Help! Save us!
Anyone in here?
Okay, so it's not actually the big one. This is a community emergency response training drill, or CERT for short, with the Long Beach Fire Department. But it feels really real.
Christian, we're coming. All right, we're gonna have to get you out of here for more help, okay?
Three emergency response trainees have found a teenage boy who's pretending his right abdomen was impaled by a stick. And his injuries look pretty real. The trainees are learning how to assess victims, to properly transport them, and perform basic triage. In this case, they lift the boy onto a chair and then down the stairs.
Oh my God, where's my daughter? You guys, where's my daughter?
It's chaotic, just like it would be in a real disaster. There's a guy with third-degree burns all over his body. At least, that's how it looks.
What happened?
Building caught on fire. Earthquake. He's all burned up.
The burns aren't real. They're the work of moulage artists who apply fake injuries. There's a lot of blood, people with glass in their arms, burns on their bodies.
This event really is designed to push them and really make them work together as a team to come together, provide first aid under disaster medical operations, also provide search and rescue operations and medical or fire suppression.
That's Jake Heflin, a firefighter. He's also the program manager for CERT Long Beach. Today's drill is a culmination of two full days of training. It's based on real-life estimates of a 7.8 magnitude earthquake hitting SoCal. A quake like that would kill around 2,000 people, injure another 50,000, cause billions of dollars of damage, destroying freeways and leaving the region without gas, electricity, and water. Earthquakes of this magnitude historically occur every 150 years. It's been 300 years since the last one. Long Beach CERT is working to make sure its community will be ready.
Get your arm.
We brought him in.
The training is designed to give ordinary folks the tools to save lives, like getting somebody out from under a car.
This person is alive, and I'm going to need one other person so when they get the vehicle up to help me pull the body out.
On any given day in Long Beach, Heflin says there are around 124 firefighters on duty. The city has 500,000 residents. That's roughly one firefighter for every 5,000 people. He says when disaster hits, they will be overwhelmed. No question.
So we will rely on volunteers that are trained in CERT, other volunteers that are passionate about contributing to the community to support and assist those in need, to be able to rally, to be able to come together and do the greatest good for the greatest number of people in the shortest amount of time.
CERT is the fire department's force multiplier. It's their way of training the community to be able to take care of itself in a disaster. After the drill, many participants say they feel empowered. Here's Danica Potts.
It makes me feel like, okay, instead of fear being my first instinct, react and respond and see, okay, what's our plan? You know what I mean? Plan, not fear. Big difference.
2 days ago, Potts was just an ordinary community member.
I put out a fire. I saved 2 lives.
CERT hopes they'll put these skills to use not only when disaster strikes, but also in everyday life.
Congratulations, everybody. You did an awesome job out there, and I'm just really proud.
More than 1,000 people have graduated from CERT programs in Long Beach since they started, because you just never know when the big one's coming. What we do know, however, is that luck favors the prepared.
Was Take Two contributor Adriana Cargill. For more info on community emergency response training in your area, visit the website ready.gov. From earthquakes to climate change. To help combat greenhouse gas emissions and cut back on pollution, the city of Oxnard received grant funding to help plant fruit trees in people's yards. Residents can choose between lime, lemon, orange, peach, or avocado trees. Everyone in Oxnard is encouraged to apply, but priority will be given to those who live in communities disproportionately affected by pollution. You can see which neighborhoods those are by looking at your Cal EnviroScreen score, which is measured by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. One tree will be given out per household, but fair warning, should you want and get one of these trees planted in your yard, it'll be up to you, the homeowner or renter, to maintain it and to eat the fruits of your labor, of course. All right, that's it for Take Two this Thursday. I'm Josie Huang. It's been so great filling in for A. Martinez and hanging out with the Take Two crew. A will be back tomorrow. Please join him.